The old head of Kinsale is a fine place for a picnic. Its high cliffs offer spectacular views out across the Irish Sea. On May the 7th, 1915, a young lad called George Henderson and his family were eating their sandwiches and admiring a huge liner with four funnels as it steamed majestically eastwards, clearly bound from America towards Liverpool. Then suddenly, everything went surreal. A plume of water and smoke burst skyward. The liner's bows started to sink, its stern reared up into the air, and in less than 20 minutes, it had disappeared beneath the waves. 70 years later, George Henderson still hadn't forgotten witnessing the death plunge of the Lusitania.
As a six-year-old boy, it is something which has stuck in me mind for the rest of my life. Although time fades and the grey cells wear out, I can still sit here now and see that great liner just sliding below the waves.
There was never any question about who was responsible. The German press made the captain of the U-boat who'd fired the fatal torpedo into a national hero. It justified the attack on the grounds that the liner was secretly shipping arms and ammunition to Britain, with whom Germany had been at war since the summer of 1914. But the PR problem for the Germans was that the liner's main cargo was ordinary passengers, and nearly 1,200 of them had died in the tragedy. Newsmen sent back gruesome reports of the makeshift mortuary in the market hall at Queenstown in Southern Ireland, where most of the bodies were laid. This was the account in the London Times.
Men broke down when they looked upon a young mother lying there with her baby folded in her protective arms. Nearby, a sailor who was found with the body of a little child strapped to his shoulders. Queenstown is seething with the fury of men who ask themselves what they can do to make the Germans answerable for this appalling crime.
There was fury in the United States as well, because 128 Americans had gone down with the Lusitania. This seems an almost trivial death toll today, after the century of Hitler, Stalin and Pol Pot. But in 1915, the sinking seemed an act of utter barbarity, and millions of Americans always remembered exactly where they were on hearing the news. For some, it was tantamount to a declaration of war. But President Woodrow Wilson viewed things very differently. Since August 1914, when war broke out in Europe, he had done his best to keep America neutral. He believed the country had a special peacemaking mission, and he also feared that entering a world war abroad could start a civil war at home.
The people of the United States are drawn from many nations, and chiefly from the nations now at war. Some will wish one nation, others another, to succeed in the momentous struggle. Such divisions among us might stand seriously in the way of the proper performance of our duty as the one great nation at peace. The United States must be mutual in fact as well as name during these days that are to try men's souls.
Wilson laid out this abiding goal in August 1914, to stand above the war so that America could shape the peace. Although instinctively an Anglophile, loving England's country and literature, the president didn't believe either side had a monopoly of right in this conflict. The Lusitania was a case in point. The German U-boat had committed an atrocity, but the British liner had been secretly carrying weapons of war. So although he was shaken by the sinking, the attack didn't change his fundamental policy. In any case, the president had other things on his mind. Although nearly 60 years old, he was head over heels in love. Wilson's first wife had died at the start of the war, leaving him distraught with grief. He was by nature a loner, clever, intense, with a keen Presbyterian sense of his own rectitude, and he relied on female company to unwind. Introduced the following spring to Edith Gaunt, a vivacious and attractive widow in her 40s, he was absolutely entranced, and within 6 weeks had proposed. Mrs. Gaunt was taken aback. As she recalled later,
I said the first thing that came to my mind without thinking it would hurt him. Oh, you can't love me, for you don't really know me, and it is less than a year since your wife died.
But she didn't rebuff him completely. This was on May the 4th, 1915, 3 days before the Lusitania went down. So both Wilson's mind and his heart were in turmoil when he went to speak in Philadelphia on May the 10th, especially since before leaving the White House, he'd had another, more encouraging tête-à-tête with Edith. In his speech to new citizens, immigrants from all over Europe who'd just taken the oath of allegiance, he celebrated the uniqueness of America.
This is the only country in the world which experiences this constant and repeated rebirth. Other countries depend upon the multiplication of their own native peoples. This country is constantly drawing strength out of new sources. The example of America must be a special example. The example of America must be the example not merely of peace because it will not fight, but of peace because peace is the healing and elevating influence of the world, and strife is not. There is such a thing as a man being too proud to fight. There is such a thing as a nation being so right that it does not need to convince others by force that it is right.
As usual, Wilson spoke off the cuff from notes. Naively, he hadn't realized that the line about being too proud to fight, the sort of advice his mother gave him about dealing with schoolyard bullies, would be taken as a statement about the Lusitania. But he wasn't thinking straight, as he wrote to Edith afterwards.
I do not know just what I said in Philadelphia, because my heart was in such a whirl from that wonderful interview of yesterday, and the poignant appeal and sweetness of the little note you left with me. I am waiting, and am already your own.
The ill-judged phrase about being too proud to fight did enormous damage. In London, people joked that Wilson was too scared to fight. On the Western Front, shells that failed to explode were nicknamed Wilsons. Ex-President Theodore Roosevelt, who saw the war as an apocalyptic battle of good and evil, in which America should ally itself with Britain and France against German militarism, railed that Wilson and his colleagues were
abject creatures, and they won't go to war unless they are kicked into it.
Wilson backed away from what he had said at Philadelphia, but the too proud to fight speech actually expressed his deepest sentiments, that America should set an example of peace in a warring world, showing a transcendent concern for the interests of humanity as a whole. But that meant stopping Germany's U-boat warfare. Otherwise, more crises like the Lusitania would make US neutrality untenable. So Wilson began a war of words with Berlin, tapping out diplomatic notes of protest on his own typewriter. It took a year of diplomacy and more American deaths. But eventually in May 1916, after Wilson had threatened to break off diplomatic relations, the Germans gave the pledge that he wanted. They agreed that in future, U-boats would not attack passenger vessels without warning. It was a major victory for Wilson. The typewriter, it seemed, was mightier than the sword. And in domestic affairs, the president's notes also bore fruit. Edith Gault became Mrs. Wilson. Yet the United States wasn't as neutral as Wilson claimed. Its trade was closely entangled with that of Britain, and US banks like J.P. Morgan started raising massive loans for the Allies. In other words, whatever Wilson said about Americans being neutral in sentiment, the US economy had become heavily biased against Germany. And there was little Wilson could do about it. He won re-election in 1916 thanks to the war boom. By now, both sides were deadlocked on the battlefield. So economic warfare seemed the main hope of victory. That's why the Germans had resorted to unrestricted U-boat warfare until Wilson reined them in. But he was equally angry about Britain ratcheting up its naval blockade of Germany, blacklisting US companies suspected of trading with the enemy. In the summer of 1916, Wilson told an advisor,
"This blacklist business is the last straw. I am seriously considering asking Congress to authorize me to prohibit loans and restrict exportations to the Allies. Can we any longer endure their intolerable course?"
The president reckoned that Britain was now so economically dependent on America that it would have to come to heel. And that was certainly the fear in London. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Reginald McKenna, warned the cabinet in October 1916,
"If things go on as at present, I venture to say with certainty that by next June or earlier, the President of the American Republic will be in a position, if he wishes, to dictate his own terms to us."
At the end of that year, Wilson's efforts at peacemaking went into high gear. He sent identical notes to both sides, asking them to spell out their war aims.
"The objects which the statesmen of the belligerents on both sides have in mind in this war are virtually the same."
The insinuation that the Allies were on the same moral level as Germany aroused deep anger in London. Reportedly, the King wept when he read the note. But suddenly, the whole situation was transformed. In January 1917, Germany decided to resume all-out submarine warfare, shooting on sight all shipping, belligerent or neutral, warship or merchantman, bound for Britain and France. This was a direct breach of the 1916 pledge to Wilson. The German High Command knew it was risking war, but reckoned that an all-out U-boat campaign could cut the Allies' Atlantic lifeline before the US got its act together. Wilson now had little choice, and on April the 2nd, 1917, he asked a special session of Congress to declare war formally on Germany. But he was still insisting that the United States had its own special agenda, on a higher moral plane from Britain and France.
"We have no selfish ends to serve. We desire no conquest, no dominion. We seek no material compensation for the sacrifices we shall freely make."
And in a phrase that echoed around the world and down the 20th century,
"The world must be made safe for democracy."
Edith Wilson accompanied her husband to Capitol Hill. Afterwards, she wrote in her diary,
"Through cheering multitudes, we drove home in silence. The step had been taken. We were both overwhelmed."
Congress approved the war message, and on Good Friday, April the 6th, 1917, Woodrow Wilson signed the Declaration of War. No longer too proud to fight, he was now ready to go to war for America's pride. But more than that, for a new and better world. It was a noble mission, but one that would end in tragedy. Thank you.